Hope Spiritual Life at NYU, and this is Multifaithful, the podcast about religious diversity, multifaith dialogue, and effing the ineffable. On this week's podcast, I am joined by Sarab Al-Jizaki, president of the Network of Arab American Professionals, as well as one of the most well-known organizers and activists in the United States for issues going on in Syria for Syrian refugees. He has come to speak at NYU quite a few times throughout the year and given incredible insight to our students, and we thought having him on a podcast to give our listeners some of his perspective would be invaluable to people gaining a better understanding of the situation and what they can do to help from the United States and from wherever our listeners are. So thank you for listening to Multifaithful, and out of this week's conversation. I am joined today by Sarab Al-Jizaki, Syrian-American community organizer and advocate. Sarab, thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
And I'm joined by one of my personal favorite students at NYU and someone who spends way more time in the office than probably is good for his GPA. Asad, do you want to introduce yourself?
I'm Asad Dandia. I'm a social work student at NYU. I'm currently a senior, and I'm really happy to be here.
Great. So, Sarab, you have been asked to come to NYU quite a bit this year. There have been students who have expressed a lot of interest in either getting involved or understanding more about what's going on to help with the Syrian refugee crisis. So I'm curious if we could maybe start just with you as Sarab. Like, how did you get so involved in this, and what are some of the platforms that you're working on this issue right now?
Sure. Well, I got involved with it just by nature of my history as an Arab American and American Muslim community organizer for over 15, 20 years. And so I've been involved in organizing to empower our broad community in many different ways pre-Syria revolution. I am a Syrian American, and therefore, once the revolution hit, I focused a lot of my energies towards supporting the needs of my brothers and sisters back home, whether it was advocacy work, political work, humanitarian aid, or just straight resourcing, connecting dots across, you know, disparate communities. And so when the refugee catastrophe occurred, and as it kind of built up, one of the things we wanted to do was raise humanitarian aid. And actually, you know, on one side, it was specifically the attack on people to shift activists to focus less on political work and focus more on humanitarian aid, which was one of the goals of the Assad regime. He wanted to push people away from political work and advocacy and push them towards daily survival. And that's why you saw a whole slew of Syrian activists abroad and here move towards the humanitarian to respond to the terrible tragedy. But sadly, it was part of the general tactic to extend the life of the regime. But with that said, you know, a lot of our work has been to focus on raising awareness as to what people are dealing with over there. In late 2012, I went to the Atma refugee camp. Actually, it's a displaced, internally displaced camp inside of Syria, right across the Turkish border, to see with my own eyes what people were dealing with. And what I saw was something that, you know, even the worst films couldn't even bring it to life for you. And you saw thousands upon thousands of people who had been bombed out of their towns and villages, living basically in mud. You know, no running water, no sewage system, just on the border, stuck under trees with makeshift tents, kids running around without shoes in the cold in the winter. No games to play, you know, just everything you could imagine about a terrible situation. And, you know, I came back here and did a ton of awareness work, media work, to kind of connect people to what was happening in this one small corner of Syria. And luckily it was successful, and, you know, they started to get a little bit more attention, more media awareness there. And, you know, I started to continue my work to broaden out across multiple areas. And then, you know, finally, when the refugee catastrophe hit the mainstream, I think we'd say late last year, the idea here as Americans was to try and advocate to our government to open the doors up a little bit, which unfortunately it really hasn't.
Right. So I was going to say, so that, I mean, very clearly has not happened yet. And if anything, because we're in a political election climate right now, I think the refugee issue has gotten bundled into a lot of other things and has become more complicated. So, for those of us who aren't as involved in the organizing efforts, maybe you could tell us, like, as a country now, where do things stand with refugees, people being let in? Is there hope around the corner for more? Like, where do things stand right now? How would you assess the situation?
Well, after a lot of pressure in the fall of last year, President Obama basically said he would raise the quotas of Syrian refugees in 2016 to 10,000 out of a total of 70,000, I think, or 85,000, whatever the total number of refugees was. That number, unfortunately, has not been hit. It's actually not being paced too well for fiscal year 2016. To date, from 2011 to today, a little over 3,000 Syrian refugees have been let in.
And just for the record, we're recording on May 3rd. So it'll come out a little later, but this is as of May 3rd.
And just to give a general sense of the response, whether it's three and a half, it's just, it's tiny, minuscule within the context of how big of a catastrophe this is. As you both know, and many of our listeners here, this is the world's largest refugee catastrophe, humanitarian catastrophe. There are over 5 million refugees who are Syrian in neighboring countries and now in Europe and beyond. But yet only 3,000 plus have been accepted here in 5+ years. They're basically at a small surge here in the United States. They're saying they're going to try and hit the 10,000 number, but it doesn't look like they're anywhere close to it.
And if we hit the 10,000 number, are there resources in place to help these people?
Well, typically when people come here after a 2-3 year vetting process, you know, one of the jokes around these campaigns is that they've made an issue about the vetting system for refugees. Refugees are probably the most vetted population that will enter the United States, oftentimes taking up to 3 years to actually get clearances multiple times over to be allowed in here. But with that said, the idea is that the number is minuscule. After 10,000, it really won't, it's still a drop in the bucket. I think advocates such as the IRC were hoping to get 100,000 immediately accepted.
Right.
Even Canada allowed 25,000 immediately with a much smaller population, much smaller base of wealth, etc. Many of the resettlement agencies are still advocating, but unfortunately in this crazy time that we live in, it's hitting a lot of deaf ears.
Yeah, and Asad, I'm curious what you think as someone who's very tapped into college-age students and general kind of the millennial, younger Muslim American advocates. I know that as some, we talk a lot about this all the time in the office. So I'm curious, like among you, your peers and friends of yours, what's the conversation happening now? What are people talking about in terms of either advocacy or resource, you know, gathering resources? Like what are your peers and college students doing?
Well, I guess I would divide that between the response of the Muslim college student community and the broader college student community. I feel like within the Muslim community, a lot of us have been, you know, aware of the crisis going on in Syria and since the Arab Spring, 2011. A lot of us have felt very helpless at the conflict itself, not knowing sort of what avenues that we can take to address the crisis on multiple levels. But as of late, because of the general, I guess, attention that the conflict has gotten, that helplessness has sort of materialized into action, where now the community is sort of pulling together all of their resources and working with different organizations and institutions locally and hopefully on a state level to, you know, both work on the humanitarian aspect of it, but also on the legal advocacy aspect of it. And so last semester, a few students and I from the Center for Spiritual Life, we sort of got together and we decided that, hey, there's this crisis going on. We need to do something about it as people of faith, people who believe that faith is more than just, you know, prayer and, you know, meditation, that we need to put our faith into action, essentially. And so just to name a few people, Sudi, Madeline, Esma, myself, Celine, Ahmed, and the entire, you know, a large number of people from MAC as well got together and decided, let's have a refugee awareness week. And that went extremely well. And it went so well that we decided that we're going to have another one this semester. And the one that happened this semester was, you know, even twice as better. Because of all the awareness that we got, we were able to, you know, have a clothing drive with the International Rescue Committee. We got in touch with people who are actually communicating with refugees. We were contacted by multiple media organizations, the Huffington Post, Al Jazeera, you know, as well as a lot of independent media outlets got in touch with us. We organized a hashtag campaign. We raised, you know, we worked alongside with the MSA to raise, I think it was this semester, I think it was like $25,000 or something along those lines for Syrian refugees to work with Islamic Relief. Mm. So I feel like we've reached a stage where we've kind of gotten an idea of, you know, how to deal with this crisis. As a graduating senior, you know, I wanted to sort of leave a model for students to adopt in the coming semester so that this doesn't become sort of like a one-time thing, but rather it evolves into a movement. And so I think there's more optimism now, both within the Muslim community on campus, also outside of the Muslim community on campus. I think the awareness that's just been, you know, raised, along with like the tools that have helped, you know, raise that awareness, so be it social media or like, you know, the Friday sermon, I think it's really, really accelerated the process of getting involved.
Yeah. And I'm curious, Sarab, so we've kind of mentioned or made passing to a few different groups that are doing areas. Mm-hmm. There's, you're part of an Arab American network, and I mean Syria, most Syrians, or a lot of Syrians would be considered Arab, so I think the Arab American community feels a particular attachment to that. There's also the Muslim American community, and while obviously not all Muslims are Arab, there's still a lot of the Syrian refugees are Muslim, and so I think there's it's a co-religionist part of a broader community. Sure, and sure. Then there have been increasingly sort of interfaith efforts or people of other religious backgrounds. I know the Pope has spoken about this numerous times, so I'm curious on your end in seeing and kind of being in a bunch of these roles and seeing a bunch of these organizations. Where do you think we need to be doing more? Like where, what groups can really be helping out here? What groups need to step up more? Who are you seeing like is always there with you? You know, like kind of, can you break down for us a little bit the landscape of what the organizing professionally kind of looks like out there?
Sure. I mean, it's a great question. I think I'll preface what I say by starting with, you know, this catastrophe is so large that people, individuals, activists, organizers, NGOs, et cetera, are doing the work that nations should be doing.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a huge gap within that, right? And so whatever we do, sometimes people are a little bit down because they feel like they're not making impact. But what I always say, whether it's a campus fundraiser where you raise $25,000 or, you know, it's a lone individual fundraiser or whatever it is, you're helping change a life. You're helping somebody live with dignity that they deserve. And so no matter how small, I encourage people to get involved in the way that they can. Mm-hmm. Utilize whatever their network is around them to make a difference. And that's where I would say I would start. I think it's up to everybody as individuals to galvanize the people around them to, one, raise awareness about the plight of refugees, not in a depoliticized sense, but just focusing on what the situation is, and then two, raising funds for them. Mm-hmm. I think that goes without saying. There are some great Arab American organizations and others as well. You know, I work specifically with NAP, but NAP is not just focused on the refugee issue. It's an empowerment organization dedicated to advancing Arab Americans. And NAP took a stance back in 2011 when the revolution started to happen that how can we empower Arab Americans and not stand for the empowerment of our brothers and sisters back in our mother countries. And since then, we've been very supportive of these kind of dignity movements across the Arab world, most notably in Syria, because it's the largest tragedy of it all. And so we've done tons of fundraisers there. We partner very closely with Islamic Relief, which is another fantastic organization. It's a U.S.-based organization that does great work from Flint, Michigan, to distributing water bottles, all the way to delivering aid to people in need inside Syria. Mm-hmm. And so I've done a lot of work with them, a lot of fundraisers with them, and they're fantastic. There's a great Syrian American organization that I like to always give a shout out to called the Karam Foundation, K-A-R-A-M. It's like a Syrian American organization. And they've been around even before the revolution. Mm-hmm. And when the revolution hit, they kind of focused towards supporting Syrians in need, both internally displaced and refugees as well. So those are some of the initial and immediate kind of places to go. On my blog, I have a list of different organizations. SarabiaNY.com.
Yeah, we'll put it in the description. We'll link to the
perfect
blog.
Thank you. Yeah, and there's a, you know, how to support Syria link page there.
So I guess the flip side of this coin of the amazing activism being done by either Arab Americans or Muslim Americans is that I feel like the rising tide of Islamophobia, both in Europe and the United States, fueled a lot by political campaigns, but also fueled just by I think a general rising tide of Islamophobia have, I'm sure, hindered these efforts in some way or made it more difficult. So how has that affected your work? Has it affected your work? Is it something that is getting a lot of coverage in the news, but just day to day isn't as big a thing? Or is it actually a much bigger deal? Like, where does it fit within, where does Islamophobia fit within the advocacy, fundraising, all the stuff you're doing for refugees?
I mean, it impacts it on a large scale. I mean, just look at the campaigns, the elections. They made a big deal about accepting, you know, up to 10,000 Syrian refugees when they had only accepted at the time about 1,000 plus, and made it into a huge national debate. So they're creating a myth around what's going on in terms of accepting of refugees, the fear of these Muslims. You know, people, even candidates talked about only accepting Syrian Christian refugees, which is just totally absurd. On so many different levels, just bigotry at its finest. So it has impacted things, the political culture, and what I call acceptable bigotry is alive and well in political circles and across the media outlets that we see day in, day out, that are consuming information about Syria. Syria, if you just mention it to everyone, will, you know, the media association will be ISIS, for example, or, you know, these images of death and destruction. And we need to make sure that we understand that there's people behind all of this. And that's part of our work. So it's been a struggle, but we continue to push forward in the way that we can.
Asad, how about for you?
Yeah, one of the things I always like to mention when the conversation around like refugees and like violence comes up, it's that the fact that, you know, when people associate terrorism with refugees, you have to, you know, point to the fact that, well, no, the refugees are fleeing from that terrorism. That same sort of terrorism that we, quote unquote, in the West are afraid of is the same type of terrorism that the refugees are fleeing from. And, you know, when you hear like Chris Christie saying that he won't even accept like children, right? Because the assumption here is that these children are like as if they're programmed to grow up to be like these rabid like extremists, and it just shows like how deeply embedded Islamophobia has become within the highest echelons of our political, you know, system. And it's just, to me as a student on a college campus, I feel like NYU has spoiled me a little bit, because I haven't experienced any like overt Islamophobia. Like, no one has ever told me like, go back to the Middle East. I'm not from the Middle East, but like usually that's
go back there anyway.
Usually that's the, you know, the first thing, or go back to your quote unquote desserts. There was a professional, he said, go back to your, he wrote, go back to your desserts, spelled desserts.
Delicious.
Yeah. So like, I've never experienced that, but I know people who outside of the NYU space have experienced that, right? You know, people, you know, being told, hey, look, it's ISIS. And then right after that, they're like hit with like, you know, weapons. You know, people will go up to your car, like throw things at you, or like women worried, like my mother, for a very long time was worried about like wearing her headscarf in public, right? She wouldn't take public transportation by herself. She said she wanted me to be with her. And like these sorts of fears, you can't really quantify them, right? You can't really measure them, but they're very real and they're out there. So the push that Muslim activists and more Muslim organizations are doing is in spite of all of this, and, you know, in the face of all of this, because it's just something that we have to stand up to and, you know, face forward, you know. And I feel like we have a strong, our community is strong enough now at this stage of the game. We have like institutions and activists who are on the ground representing us and sort of pushing back, as well as allies. We have, you know, a whole set of allies, including like here at NYU, the Center for Spiritual Life. Whenever something happens, whether there's an attack in the Muslim world, a suicide bombing, or, you know, something of the sort, there's always a vigil here. There's always people from different faith groups. We have a rabbi, we have a Christian pastor, we have a bunch of other non-faith chaplains as well giving speeches and vigils. And always, we've received emails from like the president, you know, telling us to be mindful of the fact that, you know, these fears exist. And so that really helps.
Yeah. So on the topic of sort of broader institutions, and I feel like when we talk about especially Islamophobia in New York, one of the interesting things about New York is that everything in New York City is in the shadow of 9/11, which is in a lot of ways fostering much like the legacy of that fosters much of the Islamophobia I think we deal with. But on the flip side, the Muslim community in New York is so much more present and so much more well organized here than so many other parts of the country, that just like people know more Muslim people in New York, and that is often the best indicator of breaking down prejudice, is actually knowing people of groups that are different than yours. So I'm curious, in New York and these broader organizations, what are some of the broader either Muslim or Arab American institutions that people should have on their radar screen, as like these large forces that they may not be aware of now, but they probably are going to start to come into contact with more and more as the Muslim community grows in New York, and perhaps as issues like the Syrian refugee crisis raise the profile of those organizations in New York as people want to help. So what are some of the organizations people should be on the lookout for, or people should be connecting to, or maybe some Muslim American, Arab American leaders that people should make an effort to follow on Twitter, just like, to give people access to some of these resources?
Yeah, I mean, I think institutionally there's many emerging institutions. I would say NAP is one, so naponline.org. I would say start there for kind of general Arab American issues, and as you dig into things, can focus efforts in terms of volunteerism, et cetera. The Arab American Association in Bay Ridge is one of our two main social service organizations that serve the Arab communities in both Bay Ridge and in other areas as well, but also anyone who comes in need of help. And, you know, if there is a new arrivals who are refugees or people seeking asylum, oftentimes they go to places like the association because it's the place where they can be welcomed and shown how to both assimilate while at the same time be empowered in terms of their presence here in America, which is fantastic. They're a fantastic organization. The Arab American Family Support Center is another one in terms of social service. All these organizations that I mentioned survive based on donations and through volunteer work. So there are opportunities to both donate to these groups that are all 501c3 vetted charities, and also volunteer your time to kind of help those in need.
Two more that I would add to that list would be the Muslim Consultative Network, I believe.
Yeah, great.
So their office is actually across the street from here.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it's in Judson Memorial Church.
Ah,
so you have a Muslim organization with an office in a church, right? That in itself makes a huge statement. I've attended many of their events. Actually, they're having one very soon about how Muslims can get involved working in the public sector. And so they have a space for about 100 attendees. So they're doing some really great work when it comes to like advocacy for the Muslim community in New York. There's also an organization that I actually co-founded, which focuses more on like local, like humanitarian aid, Muslims giving back. And essentially what we do is that we focus more on local services. So like we're getting undocumented families, referring them to agencies like AAANY, providing them with like basic groceries and foodstuffs. A lot of the times we've actually helped a few Syrian refugee families with like finding, like raising money for like their apartment and getting them settled. So those are two more that I wanted to add.
If you're a medical professional, I'd also add the Syrian American Medical Society, which does amazing work basically taking U.S.-based medical professionals to refugee camps, even inside Syria. They've done amazing work under really tough conditions, giving medical services to people in need of it.
And, of course, ICNYU.
Of course, yeah. I mean, that goes without saying.
We have to have a plug at the end. It wouldn't be right otherwise. So just to wrap up and kind of bring the podcast to a close, Sarab, as you're kind of looking into your crystal ball into the future, we've talked about a lot of larger forces at play here. So if I'm listening to this podcast and I haven't done much until now, we've mentioned a lot of organizations and other things. So I think I probably have a good sense of ways I can either donate money or time. In terms of political advocacy or ways to advocate, are there any ways you'd recommend for people who feel like we should be letting in more refugees, or ways to kind of make your voice heard on that front, especially as we look towards an election where people are making their voice heard on a number of fronts? So do you have a recommendation or a way to go about that maybe would be great for students?
I mean, I think first and foremost is reach out to your local elected officials and make sure that they understand that you as a constituent want to welcome in refugees and other people who are in sensitive political status states, right? Like, I think that's an important thing, and every American of all persuasions should start right there. Mm-hmm. Politics is local after all, and elected officials do listen to their constituents.
Right.
Whether they act on it on a vote, something right. depends, but they need to hear from us first. So I would start there from an advocacy perspective. Some of the organizations we discussed, depending on what's going on in the political climate, will run advocacy campaigns as mm-hmm. well. And so there's opportunities to jump on board of, you know, existing campaigns or ongoing efforts as well. But I would start with your elected officials. They want to hear from you on this issue.
Especially now.
Especially mm-hmm. now.
I think from a student perspective, one of the campaigns we had was actually a letter writing campaign mm-hmm. for Syrian Refugee Awareness Week, where we had student volunteers write letters to their elected officials. And because NYU is such a diverse community, we had students from various different states writing letters specifically to their officials. I would also say, just to branch out, get in touch with organizations that are also working both on the humanitarian aspects, so like the International Rescue Committee, which is based, I think their main office is in New Jersey, but they have an office mm-hmm. here in New York as yeah. well. So there's someone I would get in touch with. Amnesty International. I serve on the board of Amnesty International at NYU. We've also had letter writing campaigns mm-hmm. revolving around this issue, and we've held events. So for students, I would say to, you know, get in touch with activists and organizers like Sarab and others to get this awareness on a campus level, to have these events. Actually, one of our letter recipients was Bashar al-Assad. I don't know if he'll read the letter or if it'll reach
him. Seems unlikely.
But you do what you do on your end, right? Mm-hmm. So, definitely. Yeah, just get involved as a student. And if there is no organizing around Syrian refugee awareness on your campus, do what we did, start it.
I think that's a great yeah. final point, actually, is like galvanize those around you. I
yeah.
think you don't need an organization
right.
In today's world to get people around you, bring some money together, pool
yeah.
your resources together, and find a worthy organization to donate it to. So.
Yeah. Well, Asad, thank you very much, Sarab. I feel like we've been tapping you a lot recently. You're almost officially a member of NYU at this
Glad
point.
Glad to be here. Glad to be here.
But we really appreciate it and
thank
the
you.
Insight and perspective you give. So thanks for giving us your time.
Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to another episode of Multifaithful. We'd especially like to thank our guests, Sarab, as well as Asad, for joining us on the podcast and for so much insight. And his contributions to NYU throughout the year this year were really amazing. Thank you to Brian Young for editing and producing the podcast, and to Liz Spados, whose music is from the Of Many film. If you have any questions, comments, or suggestions, please be in touch at spiritual.life@nyu.edu. Please rate and review us on iTunes. We look forward to having you back next week for a different episode.